top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. There's so much to talk about. Lexi Riggin standing by to talk about the trial. Kaylee McKee White is going to break down the political side of this. But the number one story by far is across 16 states and 20 separate campuses. It's probably even more, but the ones reportable, the bigger ones. You see massive support for Hamas and the Palestinians to the detriment of Israel. And I think this is fundamentally anti-American. What happened last night about 12:45, we're off roughly, 10 hours past the deadline when they were supposed to pull out of Columbia. You had a student storm Hamilton Hall, this legendary hall named after Alexander Hamilton, and take it over. Hold four janitors against their will for hours. They came out and said they were just held back. They finally just broke through. And now they've taken it over, and they said they will not get out until they divest from Israel, which, by the way, is not going to happen. Israel invested them back and forth. 23 Democratic congressmen have already stood up and said to the management there, the administration there, fix this. They didn't. They have no way of enforcing their deadline of 2 o'clock yesterday to pull out the encampment. And now in North Carolina, 6 a.m. this morning, they moved in. They have moved in at University of Texas in Austin, trying to get these students out and make it safe for Jewish students and other students to get in. Right now at Columbia, we have a series of reporters out there. They're telling anyone who doesn't live on campus can't get on, period. The problem is people have fake IDs and have already gotten on, and a lot of these people don't belong. At UCLA, unrest is already there. We've already talked to a Jewish student who says they're not allowed to on campus. Other students wouldn't let him on because he's Jewish. Do you believe this is 2024, and we're talking about because of your religion, you can't get on to a public college at UCLA? We saw last week at USC. I don't know how any of these schools are going to have a graduation. This is totally out of control. But fundamentally, at its core, it is anti-American. Anti-American policy. They look at what's happening with Israel. They don't acknowledge October 7th. And they think basically Israel had it coming to them, the ones that do acknowledge it. They don't want to hear a counter-narrative. We're going to be following this throughout the day because we also have people like AOC, Congresswoman Omar, who fully backs the students and thinks it's great and is against NYPD moving in. My sense is they're going to move in probably within this show. Another thing taking place downtown is the trial of Donald Trump. Donald Trump against New York, that's really been the series, that's really been the theme over the last 6 months. We're starting week three. Yesterday was an off day. Today they're back in action, and they're going to be bringing up some bankers to establish that there was account opened up in order to pay off, I guess, a series of stories, whether it's Karen McDougal or there's Stormy Daniels. That's going to be the approach of the prosecution. What about the defense? And we'll talk about that with Lexi Rigdon now, attorney and legal analyst. Lexi, we'll be watching what's happening in Uptown and 160th at Columbia. But in the meantime, what's happening downtown? What do we expect today?
Well, the trial is going to resume today, and it's pretty short because they were off yesterday. They're off on Wednesdays, as they always are, so it's just going to be today. And I believe it is the continuation of Gary Farrow's testimony, who is basically just a banker who helped open these accounts. And it sort of underscores for people watching this and people who might at first have been secretly excited to be on the jury that jury service can be very, very dry. So you have an important witness, David Pecker, who testified, which I'm sure was some interesting testimony for everybody. And now you have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's and kind of bring in the more boring witnesses. No disrespect to these witnesses, but talking about opening accounts and shell companies opening accounts to get lines of credit, that's not scintillating testimony for anyone to listen to, but it's important for the prosecution because they need to explain to this jury exactly how these payments took place.
Because they want to establish what?
They want to establish that there was a campaign finance violation. They want to establish that there was miskeeping of falsification of business records. And they also want to establish that in terms of opening these accounts in shell companies, they're trying to establish that this was for the purpose of subverting the election because it was done in secret. It wasn't just a regular payment made. It was a payment made under a shell company, and Michael Cohen was involved in it, not Donald Trump. So, I mean, that argument, I think, cuts both ways. But this testimony in terms of the prosecution's case is important. The jury has to understand how this money came to be, where they got it from.
So which is interesting. Michael Cohen was the former attorney and fixer for Donald Trump. Michael Cohen set up these accounts. So for Donald Trump, he's got to get penalized because he listened to his lawyer?
Right. And, you know, it kind of is like an argument that could cut both ways. The defense is going to say, we didn't really know about this. I mean, there's no proof that he actually knew about it. Michael Cohen did this. And the prosecution is, of course, going to say, of course he knew about it. Why would Michael Cohen have done this otherwise? And you know, they were keeping Trump's hands clean. And then Trump's going to say, yeah, exactly. They were keeping my hands clean. So, you know, the testimony in and of itself in terms of the opening of the accounts and how that came to be might be a little bit dry, but it's painting the bigger picture for the jury.
Well, after that, when they have Rana Graf, who is the longtime assistant when he was a civilian businessman, they have him testify that did you ever see Stormy Daniels there? And then we have maybe Hope Hicks in the hopper, assistant when he was a civilian businessman through two stints at the White House. What would they try to build with Hope Hicks?
She might know something just about she was very close to him. And we always saw her in the press in Air Force One and kind of like his right hand woman. So she might have some information for the prosecution about what was going on at the time around the election, like when the Access Hollywood tape came out and the drama that was caused in his campaign by these negative stories coming out. So she might have something to add for the prosecution's case about that and about the panic within the campaign of bad stories. I mean, I'm just assuming that that's what they're going to be using her for, but it further paints a picture to the jury that it was important for Trump to squash these stories. Now, by the same token, in the defense, nobody wants to have their personal life and their dirty laundry aired out. I mean, what the defense had said is basically influencing campaigns is what candidates do. That's how they get elected. They influence them in, you know, the ads that they put out and the stories that are put out. So this was him doing nothing other than being a competent politician.
And that's what defense has to do. It looks like the president feels as though there should be more vigorous defense on his behalf. I've never seen three more miserable looking people than his two lawyers and Donald Trump. What do you sense that, I mean, how do you handle that? You have a client that wants to be aggressive, but you can't be aggressive with the wrong people and then make them sympathetic because you have to win over, constantly be thinking about winning over a jury, one juror in particular. So, could you describe the defense approach then?
Well, it's so hard when you have a difficult client, and I don't say that with any disrespect to Donald Trump, but some clients are a lot more passive, and they'll let the attorneys call the shots. This is a former president and also a businessman and obviously a bright and intelligent guy, and he has a certain personality style that, you know, that almost 80 years running is not going to change. So it's hard in that position as the attorney where they probably have told him, don't speak out, okay? There's no benefit to you to violating these gag orders in terms of this case. And he's probably saying, there's a ton of benefit to me violating the gag orders because I'm doing this for a greater purpose. So thanks for your advice, but I'm not taking it. So it would be very hard to have him as a client in terms of, I'm sure he is weighing in very heavily on everything that they're doing.
Right. And we'll find out if he's going to speak before, going to speak after. We know he's got a series of events planned on Wednesday. And he's going to go to the Midwest. I think maybe even do three stops, and they're back in action Thursday and Friday. The only thing I just bring back to Lexi is what is illegal and what isn't. So Stormy Daniels, here's a payment. Kara McDougal, here's a payment. Doorman with a story that doesn't exist, here's a payment. So, okay. So the jury might be like, okay, prove those payments. Yeah. I'm not denying these payments were made. Is he not? He's not denying the payments were made. He's saying that. What they're saying is they were made to win an election. Technically, okay, I wanted to go away. But he's saying it was really important for them to have David Pecker say he never brought up his family. He only brought up the election. In the past, when I did this, it was about his family. But here it wasn't. Well, that's what their hope was for the prosecution. Prove it was about the election. But then the question is, what is legal and what is not legal? What should the defense look to protect?
Well, it's all about intent, really. This case is all about intent. And it was whether, I mean, obviously the falsification of business records is what got us here. But the intent to violate campaign finance law is why this was elevated to a felony, why we're having the trial now. And so what his intent was in having these payments made is really crucial. And David Pecker can say whatever he wants about the conversations that they had, but he wasn't actually he's not in Donald Trump's brain, right? He doesn't really know. He's speculating what the intent of the payments were just based on everybody's conduct. But Donald Trump is really the one that knows what the intent of those payments was. And that's really where the rubber meets the road. And I think it would be hard to say that it was necessarily a campaign finance violation, because there are so many other reasons you would want to kill this story. And as people have exhaustively said, NDAs aren't illegal. Paying hush money isn't illegal. It's only illegal when it is for the purpose of the campaign. But it's hard to segregate the two, because he's a married man with a family and he doesn't want to be embarrassed.
Of course. Does he need to tell anyone? It's obvious. That's what his point would be. It's obvious. I don't want this to come out, because you know about the timing of when this happened. Number two, for example, with Mitt Romney, with his company, he was buying companies, and he had to oftentimes cut them up, and people had to get fired. Let's say there was four or five people very active and saying Mitt Romney should never be president. And he meets with them and he says, guys, what's it going to take for you guys to quiet down? He goes, well, $50,000 each. So he gives these guys $50,000 each to stop talking about his previous business. Would that be illegal?
If you're Alvin Bragg, it would be. I mean, and I also think that the timing of it is possibly the issue also. Well, first of all, Donald Trump is the issue. They hate him. People have run on their campaigns to get him. But Rahm Emanuel, they did the same thing for him. They did the same thing for Arnold Schwarzenegger. So this is not the first politician that this has been done for. And, you know, David Pecker has described Trump as his mentor. And so, you know, the fact that he was doing this for Donald Trump, he did it for other people too, but this was also his friend. So people have made a big deal about why on earth would you pay so much money for these stories when other stories that you caught and killed, which is the phrase the prosecution made up, you paid a lot less. Well, also, they were friends. And he testified at the end of his direct or his redirect, I think. Yeah, we were friends. I consider him a friend. He was a mentor. He was great to me. So there's that component of it, too.
Gotcha. Lastly, real quick, we watched a takeover of a building, Hamilton Hall. They renamed it after some child that died in Gaza. We watched these protesters ignore their deadline and not pick up stakes. They said that down there supposed to be suspended and off campus. They're on campus and took a building. What happens next? What are some scenarios? Number one, if I'm a student and I happen to live off campus, which most upperclassmen do, I can't get on campus. Number two, if I'm Jewish, I'm told it's not safe. Go home and Zoom. What could I do as a student to get on? Number two, what could the management of Columbia do to get control of their campus?
Well, they could be doing a lot more than what they're doing. And you see other schools, more less quote-unquote elite schools, like University of Florida, saying, this isn't a daycare, they didn't abide, we're shutting this down. And Columbia is a private institution. So, you know, people are confusing the ability to have free speech on its grounds as some type of, you know, absolute right. Columbia should have done a lot more than it did. And now things are just getting worse. And so the NYPD, Columbia has been so gutless and spineless. I don't know what it's going to take to send in the NYPD. I don't know if the mayor is going to try to do something or the governor is going to try to send in the National Guard. I sort of doubt that that's going to happen because Columbia isn't taking an aggressive approach with this. And so it is a massive problem. And can you imagine being one of these students, especially a Jewish student who has worked your entire life to get into an elite institution, gotten the good grades, did the SAT prep, and you have to deal with this utter BS. I cannot imagine how offended and angry those students and their families are.
Lexi Rigdon, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Back in a moment. If you're in the area, go give a call, 1-866-408-7669. There's some campus unrest around you. I'd love to hear your perspective on it. So I'll take some of your calls and we'll talk a little politics. The president of the United States, former president of the United States, is talking before he goes into his criminal trial right now. We'll bring some of that back to you. A lot going on. Thank goodness you're here.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think what we're seeing here is just a history. We have a history in this country of student activism and student protest. To see a university call police enforcement in on the very students that, whose safety they are in charge of, I think is extremely alarming. And I think that we really need to make sure that we are allowing the nonviolent and peaceful demonstrations to have their legitimate space.
So that is AOC. Do you think the problem is the NYPD was called in at all last week? Do you believe this? I mean, this is the mindset we're dealing with. The president of Columbia is getting reprimanded by the, they have a Senate and they have a board for bringing in the cops, for ripping up this encampment because they care about the other students that aren't activists or morons. Marty, listen on WDBO in Orlando. Hey, Marty.
Hey, Brian. Hey, Brian, when it comes to Donald Trump and some of the people that work for him, we have people like Schumer and Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries telling us that no one is above the law. But now I'm seeing college campuses being vandalized and broken into. I'm seeing Jewish students have their civil rights violated and denied. I'm seeing cops assaulted and called vile names. Where's the no one is above the law crowd now?
Great point. We all know that. And we also know that Bill Clinton paid off Paula Jones $850,000 while a president. We also know that he was doing crazy things with an intern. You don't need me to bring that up again. While president, they're bringing up stuff that happened and may have happened in 2009 about things that happened in 2016 and that we still can't find the exact charge. How they were able to get away with this, when you take a step back, sometimes we get so involved in the day-to-day, we have to take a step back. I mean, and they're looking at three more cases straight ahead. Do you realize they could give him, if they convict him, they could give him house arrest with an ankle bracelet? So he would have to give up campaigning. He's got a lead in just about every battleground state. It's small, but it's there. A national poll, two national polls that came out that shows him in front. And they might tell him, you can't leave the house. I mean, think about that. Roger, listen, WHUB in Tennessee. Roger.
Hey, I thought that the FEC was in charge of election law, and now the state of New York has taken over and trying to charge Trump with a law that belongs to the feds?
It's crazy, right? The way they explained it to me, it's a misdemeanor that has the statute of limitations run out on it, extended a little bit in some cases because of the pandemic, but still it ran out and they're trying to bootstrap it to a federal violation that gives them 34 felony charges. That's how crazy this is. It makes no sense, Roger. And thanks for the call. They'll legally, you have to see these lawyers on other channels try to rationalize what's going on. The only thing they do, and don't fall for it, is talk about some of the controversial Page Six salacious things involved in this. And when people get involved, they go, oh, this got to be illegal. That's not the point. All this stuff was in the books. It was written in. Nobody loves the Karen McDougal story, the Stormy Daniels story, true or not. The doorman story about him having a kid, totally fictitious. You know what? They all got paid off. Why? Because personally, it's embarrassing. And number two, you're trying to make sure people vote for you, not stories that are in the press as a distraction. Kaylee McGee White will talk more about the political ramifications of all this and latest on the Columbia protests. Don't move.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
These are very sad pictures. Students have a right to protest. They have a right to express themselves. They don't have a right to disrupt. And it's very clear that there's substantial disruption on many campuses. And administrations have agonizingly difficult choices to make. I wish they had made the decision not to allow these students to enter in the first place. I wish they had been much stronger in responding to earlier provocations, of which there have been many since October 7th.
That is Larry Summers, former president of Harvard. He is a former Treasury Secretary, and he's very well respected on financial matters. Always quick to, on a side note, to criticize things and praise them regardless of who's in charge. I've noticed that over the last few years, extremely upset about what's happening over at Harvard, where he used to run it. And we know what happened at Yale. There's already cops been called in. We'll keep you up to date on that. At Harvard, they just let the, after a couple of days trying to stay ahead of it, they now allowed their campus to be virtually overrun and their flag taken down, red, white, the stars and stripes taken down, and the Palestinian flag put up. And they're still seeing major disruptions with 2 weeks to go in the semester. Joining us now is Kaylee McGee-White, senior fellow at the Independence Women's Forum and a fine columnist in her own right. Kaylee, great to see you. First off, before we get to with 2024, and there's a lot, I do want to get your take on this campus uprising. 20 campuses, 16 separate states. We're seeing Columbia now, they're taking over buildings.
Yeah, and I would disagree with Larry Summers on multiple points. The first being that colleges don't have an agonizing decision. It's actually quite a simple one, which is to shut down the protest, suspend or expel anyone who's been involved in them and who refuses to abide by the campus codes. And I know there's been a lot of debate about whether students have a free speech right to protest in favor of Palestine. Yes, of course you have a free speech right. However, campus codes have codes of conduct exist at every single university. And the entire point of those conduct codes is to regulate student behavior, student rhetoric. Schools have the right to do that. And everything that we're seeing right now at Columbia, Yale, all these other universities is in direct violation of those conduct codes. So if the schools don't do something about this here, then we should really be asking, what is the point of those conduct codes at all?
Great point. And it's not just Harvard, it's Yale, North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Today, we watch cops go in and just rip up those tents and drag these students out. Still wild protests on the outside. But what really bothers me more than the pup tents is what's happening to Jewish students. At UCLA, this Eli Sivis, he's just on with us on television. Here's what he said last night. He put video online of him just trying to walk on campus. I want you to hear this. He's being stopped by six or seven people wearing the Yasser Arafat outfits covering their face. Cut nine.
We're going this way. You guys have closed the entrance. We are UCLA students. I have my ID right here. I'm being blocked off, not by the security guard, but by you two. You three. Oh, look, they're making their burger while I'm going this way. Excuse me. This is what they do. Everybody, look at this. Look at this. I'm a UCLA student. I deserve to go here. We pay tuition. This is our school. And they're not letting me walk in. My class is over there. I want to use that entrance.
So they were just stopping him. And he could have pulled his way in. He was bigger than most of them. But they were blocking him. And he had a Star of David around his chest. Can you believe we're talking about this?
No, it's insane. And I've seen multiple law firms, you know, publicly reach out to him on Twitter and offer to take up his case. Because he has a strong one. This is intimidation. It's harassment. It's not even just a violation of the school's conduct codes, it's actually breaking the law. You cannot intimidate another student and physically harass them in that way. So I do hope that he turns this into a legal case of his own. And you're right. I mean, under it all is this deep anti-Semitic hatred for Jewish students, for Jewish people. And ultimately, it's also an example of anti-Western hatred. A lot of these students are not just protesting Israel. They're protesting against the United States, against random Western features such as capitalism, some of the signs that you see on campuses. It's clearly a very deep-rooted hatred for everything that the United States and Israel stand for.
I want you to hear what KJP said yesterday. She couldn't even guarantee that the president knows what's going on or is watching it because he's so consumed with the truce talks. We can't get two flat screens to the presidents. You don't think that we have a way for him to see two things at once? If he can't multitask, he's really in the wrong job. But listen to her have no answer for anything. Cut five.
The president has always been clear that while Americans have the right to peacefully protest, that's something that we believe here in this administration, he stands squarely against any rhetoric, violent rhetoric, any hate threats.
And then he went on. Check this out. I want you to hear what he said. She said that he said about Columbia. Cut six.
The protesters themselves have now defied that 2 p.m. deadline. Should they leave?
The protesters themselves have?
Yeah. Yes, there was a deadline for them to leave by 2 p.m., and they have not done so. What does the White House think?
You mean that Colombia has said there is a 2 p.m. deadline for them? Okay. I'm just not going to comment on leadership at colleges and university, their decisions.
I mean, Donald Trump has put out on Truth Social a bunch of times, clear out the campuses, get control of the campus. I mean, is this time to lead or what?
Yeah, and why is the White House so hesitant to denounce these in clear, strong terms? It makes no sense. It's not like these universities are independent entities from the government. They're federally funded. They take our taxpayer dollars. So yes, the president does have the authority to leverage those federal funds and say, hey, if you're violating civil rights laws by refusing to protect your Jewish students, we're going to do something about it. And the fact that he is refusing to even clearly denounce this as anti-Semitism is very telling.
Right. I want to talk about 2024. You've seen the latest polls. The president up by 6 points without RFK. With RFK, he's up 9 points. Some different battleground states, they show very tight race. That's not a surprise. But I believe there's a degree of panic because they've done everything to Donald Trump except actually lock him up, and he keeps winning. And here's how I know there's panic. I want you to hear the exchange on MSNBC. The Democratic Party basically programs the whole channel. Katie Turr with Nancy Pelosi, cut 33.
Donald Trump has the worst record of job loss of any president. So we just have to make sure people know.
That was a global pandemic.
He had the worst record of any president. We've had other concerns in our country. If you want to be an apologist for Donald Trump, that may be your role, but it ain't mine. And
I don't
he has
think
the worst.
That anybody can accuse and me of that.
Do you believe this? I mean, that's her, the most overrated politician, the woman who rips up the State of the Union, got away with one of the most rancid displays in politics ever. And people look up to her, but you push back on her, and she just she bares her fangs.
Well, and you know it's bad when even MSNBC has to fact check Nancy Pelosi on Donald Trump. And, you know, the polls have one consistent finding, which is that when voters are asked who was the better president, a stunning majority
yes.
say Donald Trump. They say their lives were better under Trump's presidency. And I think that that's the question that is really at the root of this election cycle. And it's why the Trump legal cases aren't really touching his lead in these swing states. It's why Biden's attempt to campaign on niche issues like climate change or abortion aren't doing much to help him, because people are looking at the overall quality of their lives and they're saying, wait, we get to weigh both presidential records here and we get to determine who was the better president. And that's why so many people are saying, actually, it's Trump.
Right. I mean, look, we have 5.5 months. There's a lot of game to play and there's the world events that are taking place. But anybody who looks at the world and says, wow, the adults are back in the room. Look at the Middle East. Look at Europe. Look at China. Do you know China's now setting up an outpost, I think, in Antigua and the Caribbean, all aimed at us while having a huge influence in Venezuela as well as Cuba? Please tell me where the world has settled down and things have gotten better. Here's James Carville. More indications to me that he's beginning to panic because he's seeing the young vote, which has been firmly in the Democratic corner, dissipate. Cut 35.
I hear this a lot. Young voters are just not into this. It's two candidates. One's in the 80s. One's is almost in the 80s. And they're concerned about things that Washington are politicians. And you just can't blame them for, oh, you. And you tell these young people, if you don't get involved right now in this election, they're going to be involved in your life for the rest of your freaking life. But that's all right, you little 26-year-old. You don't feel like the election's important to me. They're not addressing the issues that I care about.
You don't have to be sober to do a podcast. That's clear. But do you hear the anger and frustration?
Absolutely. And this is a demographic that Biden really relied on back in 2020. Young voters turned out pretty overwhelmingly for him. And the fact that he's lost so many in such a short time span. And this isn't recent, by the way. Young voters started disapproving of Biden within his first year in office, in large part because they saw their own economic conditions go down the drain so fast. And I'll just say, as a young voter myself, I think that, you know, the country misunderstands the issues that we care about. A lot of people will look at the student protests on campus. A lot of them will look at young voters' support for climate change policies and think that those are the issues that drive young voters. But recent polls actually show the exact opposite. There was a Harvard poll last week that found that climate change, Gaza, ranked at the very bottom of the priority list for young voters. At the top were the economy, inflation, crime, affordable housing. So we're not that much different than older generations in that we're ultimately going to act in our self-interest and vote for whoever is going to provide us the best quality of life.
By the way, this just came across. We watched Donald Trump say a few kind of comments about 5 minutes right before he went into court. He's with his son today. I think that's reassuring for him, by the way. Eric's there. He's been fine. He's going to be there all week. He's been fined $8,000 for the gag order violations. Obviously, that is not a problem, but that's what they wanted to slow it up. They had to have that half day hearing. Then they needed 2 days to deliberate. So that's how this day started. And in court, we understand there's going to be a banker on there that opened up an account. It's going to say Michael Cohen opened up the account. I thought Jonathan Turley had the best line today. He was on with us this morning because the Cubs are playing the Mets. And he's a big Cubs fan. And he was in studio. And he said, essentially, they're going after Trump for listening to his lawyer's advice as advised by his lawyer who's testifying against him. They're going to say that Michael Cohen opened that account. David Perry goes, yeah, Michael Cohen opened that account. I mean, this is a bizarre case.
It is, and it's really bizarre that Trump was under a gag order while Michael Cohen was allowed to, you know, rant as much as he wanted against the former president, insult the former president on however many podcasts he wanted. He's been out doing the exact same thing that he's accusing Trump of, and yet only Trump is the one who's been ordered to remain silent by the court. And I think that Trump is right to highlight, the implications here. If the former president is not allowed to speak about his own case publicly, there are free speech implications there. He's a national candidate. He is the Republican Party's candidate for the presidency. He is on the campaign trail, and he is essentially being told by the court that you are not allowed to speak about a case that affects your 2024 race. So again, it's another example of Democratic lawfare attempting to cripple Trump's campaign.
And just a quick note, Michael Cohen is also on TikTok doing live streams, taking questions, and it's also... yeah, it's one of those things where you can actually earn money by doing it. So if I'm the defense attorney, I'm sitting there taking notes what Michael Cohen's saying, devising my plan, how to cross-examine. Kaylee McGee-White, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And in case you don't know, Kaylee's been Skyping. So you not only got a chance to see, if you were on the app and hit watch, you were able to hear her and see her. Thanks, Kaylee.
Thank you.
All right. Meanwhile, we come back. Your calls again, 1-866-408-7669. Again, Donald Trump, as I mentioned, fined $8,000 just now for gag order violations. I'm pretty sure he can afford it. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back. I have a lot to discuss. A couple of things. $9,000 it is. Donald Trump's been fined for violating his gag order. They asked for 11. He got 9. I don't think he's worried about it. There also is a stronger tone coming from the White House. The White House came out and said, condemns the takeover of that building, Hamilton Hall, in Columbia. Peaceful protests, okay, but not what they saw last night. That's notable. It would be great to see the president on camera to say it. But what I always get is who's funding this. That's the first thing I think about. And when we were at Henderson, Nevada, the questions we got when I talked to people over the weekend, that was a common question. This seems too organized. The tents are all the same. The money is fanned out all across the country. What's going on here? Some of these activists, most of them perhaps, are not even from the school. William Agnes did some research for Fox and gave it to Brett Baer last night, a special report. I wanted to bring it back for you. Get a pen handy. Here's the answer.
Who are they? What do they want? And where is their money coming from?
The Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, all of them have supported anti-Israel causes.
The center-right Capital Research Center says liberal foundations also support the campaign for Palestinian rights. Hundreds of thousands coming from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and George Soros Open Society Foundation over the last 3 years. The group's own website says the money pays for banners and signs, $1,000 a month in salaries for fellows who go campus to campus running anti-Israel campaigns. Target audience, 15 to 35-year-olds committed to an abolitionist future. They provide toolkits and look for other students who may share their worldview, in their words, feminists and queers, black and indigenous people.
An indigenous woman here on Autumn Land. This is our land.
Fellows include the woman who disrupted a private dinner at UC Berkeley, a man arrested at Yale for trespassing, and a University of Texas activist detained by police. Protest groups go by different names. The largest, Students for Justice in Palestine, receive money from a liberal New York foundation called Westpac, as well as student activity fees, according to the pro-Israel NGO Monitor.
That the money that's provided does come, in some cases, from student fees. And students who pay those fees have the absolute right to know where their money's going.
Arizona State allows students to opt out of funding clubs they oppose. These other universities decline to say how much student money goes to pro-Palestinian groups. Both the Soros and Rockefeller Foundation say their grant-making is for peace in the Middle East.
So that's a lot of money, fanned out, even as low as 15 years old. As low as 15 years old. So we're seeing that. The president already spoke. Right now, the Columbia students have busted windows, temporarily kept four janitors as hostage, took over Hamilton Hall, and now they in the building. If you want to get on the campus of Columbia, you're going to you have to live there. Even if you have a student ID, if you don't live there, just go Zoom at home. Keep in mind, a lot of these kids need the library. They're in advanced degrees in very challenging school. They just want to get on campus. They cannot. And also, we also heard too that even though the campus is locked down, we had one student on right before I left Fox and Friends today who said they're sneaking in the back way. So that's pretty, it tells you. They know exactly what they're doing. They're up to no good. And my sense is kids sneaking in are not kids sneaking in. These are activists on campus, great havoc. And they love the attention they're getting. You know who else loves it more? Sinwar. And all those Hamas fighters still left, they think they're winning the PR war. It's up to Americans to stand up and let them know they are not. Right now, it doesn't look strong.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, there is so much breaking in Manhattan. It is really where global news normally is, but not like today. I mean, you think about what's happening in Midtown where we are at. You have Donald Trump, Trump Tower, where Donald Trump left today to go to court. He's already spoken today. He's now in court. He's been fined $9,000 for violating his gag order. It's $9 to you and I, or 9 cents to him. So I don't think that's a big deal, but it is notable. Maybe he gave a warning. We don't know the details yet. And then we have the unrest on college campuses around the country in 20 separate states. The worst is Columbia, where they've taken over a building. And before we get to our great guest, Gerard Baker of the Wall Street Journal, we have Scott Bessent, who's going to be on in a little while, self-made multibillionaire who will have a prominent role should Donald Trump win election, maybe Treasury Secretary, and then Stuart Varney, and will do a simulcast with us. So, and we'll take your call. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
You know, I'll tell you what we call this in the world of trials. We call this trial psychosis. When you're in the heat of battle or you're commenting on a case that is in the heat of battle, your perspective tends to take over the way you think. It's sort of a groupthink scenario. Let's look at it that way.
We're looking at the Trump trials. It's week number three. On tap today, the prosecution tries to reassemble Trump's 2016 team to try and prove election interference or something. We'll talk about that.
Number two.
You know, you have to look at this from DeSantis' point of view. You know, he can't run again. His term ends. He'll be a man without a job unless he could be brought into the Trump administration, where a guy of his competence and ability might be a welcome addition.
Absolutely. And it looks like they're back together. The rock star governor Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump bury the hatchet and hatch a plan to work together to oust Joe Biden, as Dems seem to be getting testy and angry about their political prospects. I'll let you hear it.
Number one.
I think these are anti-war protests, and I think it's very distressing that we are framing these as pro-Palestinian protests or pro-Israeli protests. protest. They don't want students on these campuses to voice their opinions.
What? The View continues to be laughable, although there's no laugh track. You could just laugh at home. Sonny Hostin. Campus defiance as dozens of colleges occupied by activists and students, and in the case of Columbia, defying demands to disperse and instead take over a building, the Hamilton building. We're going to look at the campus chaos, anti-Semitic rage, and silence from Joe Biden and his administration. They did come out moments ago and just condemn the takeover of building. But let's go right now to Gerard Baker. Gerard, great to see you. Your thoughts about the unfolding events before we get to your column.
Two things on the thanks, Brian, very much. Thanks for having me. Two things about these events across the country and universities. And as you say, we've seen a lot here in New York City and Columbia. One is these are not randomly, autonomously generated protests by students. These are organized by pro-Hamas terrorist groups, terrorist-friendly groups. I had on my own podcast, Brian, last week, Shai Davidai, who's a professor at Columbia, who outlines in great detail who these groups are. Of course, these students are sympathetic. That's why they're doing these things. But we shouldn't be under any illusions that this is a very carefully orchestrated, ultimately backed by Iran, ultimately backed by these Islamist terrorists, that is trying to drive this support for, which is what it is, support for Hamas in this war against Israel. That's a very important first point. The second point I've just got to say, though, Brian, is, you know, this is, as you watch this, this is becoming a nightmare for Joe Biden. We've got the Democratic Convention in Chicago, of all places. Those of us who are old enough to remember 1968, remember what happened then over a war protests in 1968. Democrats are meeting in what? A little over 3 months in Chicago. These groups, again, organized by these pro-terrorist groups, but all with this backing of the left, the far left, and these students. You know, this is a nightmare for them. But. This is, you know, there's a saying, as you reap, so shall ye sow. As you sow, so shall ye reap. That is, they have been sowing, the left has been sowing these Marxist, far left, Black Lives Matter, pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian, white, anti-white identity groups for years and years and years on these campuses. And it's coming home to roost. This is what we're seeing right now.
So, what's so interesting is that the Republicans aren't even a factor. They came out, they speak their mind. The speaker got shouted down, to his great credit. He spoke his way through it. Donald Trump has been direct. Clean up these college campuses. Yeah. He's doing it on put on Truth Social. You do have now a move by the congressman from New York, Lowry, who came out and said there's an anti-Semitic bill. It's moved forward. He's got 23 Democrats to support it. So they know exactly where they're going. Mm. But these activists have their eyes set on condemning this administration.
Yeah.
Do they know that it's the best they're ever going to get?
Genocide Joe, as they call him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, I do think part of it is they don't care. They are revolutionaries, right? They don't really care about the outcome of elections, you know, because they don't particularly like Joe Biden or like Donald Trump. They are revolutionaries. They are people who want to sow discord in this country. They are people who want to undermine the values of this country and, crucially, undermine America's allies in the world. That's what we're seeing here. Israel is America's greatest ally in the Middle East, one of its greatest allies in the world. It's fighting a war for its own survival. And what you've got is large numbers of Americans themselves, you know, doing it themselves, but also agitated and provoked and organized by these essentially anti-American, pro-terrorist, pro-Islamist groups. And they are succeeding. So they don't, again, they don't care if Joe Biden wins. In some ways, they'd probably be quite happy if Joe Biden loses because they'll have even more to protest about. So it is about sowing discord and about weakening America in its resolve to fight to support its allies and to preserve its own
security. And just playing into this, on the other side, their answer is, Joe Biden, we don't even know if the president had a chance to see the unrest on campus. I guess he doesn't have two flat screens in his office. But he's talking about the truce.
Yeah,
so he's pushing Netanyahu to come up with some type of ceasefire and this ridiculous hostage exchange.
Yeah.
When they see this, Sinwar and these lunatics, the Hamas guys, see this unrest, they think they're winning.
Of course they do.
They think the longer they hold out, the better deal they're going to get, the more these hostages suffer.
This has been the Hamas strategy, Brian, from the very start. They went in on October 7th, committed those horrific atrocities, which we've all seen. some people still deny, by the way, but which we've all seen, knowing they didn't think they were going to destroy Israel in that moment. They wanted to kill as many Jews as they could, obviously, because that's what they live for. But what they really thought is they would provoke an Israeli response. Israel would have to respond and go after them. And literally, as we saw, Brian, at the time, within days of an atrocity on the scale, you know, compared to Israel's size, 10 times the scale of 9/11 here in the United States in terms of the scale of the Israeli population. Within days of Israel going after the people who committed this atrocity, the rest of the world was saying, you know, the Europeans and Democrats here, to be fair, initially Biden was supportive, but within months, Biden was saying, oh, no, you've got to back off now, we've got to have a ceasefire. This was entirely the Hamas strategy all along. They knew they would get as many Palestinian civilians killed, because not only do they not care about that, they want Palestinian civilians to die, so the rest of the world will come out and accuse Israel of committing atrocities. It's worked exactly as Hamas wanted to. And if Biden continues to insist on a ceasefire, a truce, you know, as you say, we'll see what happens with these hostages, that is playing exactly into Hamas's hands and Iran's hands.
And they got to finish off Rafah. That's what they have to do. They got to get the last remnants of Hamas.
And this, you know, we've talked about this before, Brian, others have too, but, you know, this idea that Israel is committing horrendous numbers is killing horrendous numbers of civilians. I mean, first of all, one, as I just said, that's exactly what Hamas wants. That's why they hide among the civilian population in hospitals and mosques and all that kind of stuff. So civilians are going to get killed. Secondly, even though that is the case, by historic standards, Israel is conducting a war in an urban environment where it is actually killing far fewer civilians per combatant that it kills than most military do that.
What you just said. Yeah. What is wrong with President Biden saying every civilian who dies is a tragedy, but it's never the intention? And he gives the ratios that you gave that we figured out over the weekend going by Hamas numbers. That's called leadership.
Yeah.
That's moral clarity. And the president, let the chips fall where they may.
Brian, you've said it many times yourself. Brian has never shown any leadership. You know, Biden has never shown any leadership. The situation we have here is political. You know, he is terrified. Looks at these protests on campus, worries about what may be happening at the convention in Chicago, worries about, you know, losing voters in Dearborn, Michigan, and maybe in Minnesota, as we saw in the primary. You know, the sort of terrible, you know, rather crude joke about Biden right now is that he's interested in a two-state solution, the two states being Pennsylvania and Michigan, or Michigan and Minnesota. That's what he's most concerned about. He knows in a close election, he could lose the votes of the far left, these young kids, they go and vote for Cornell West, or they vote for somebody else, and he loses Michigan and Pennsylvania. It's over for him. So that's what it's about. So but that fits entirely with Biden's entire political career. No leadership. You go where the Democratic Party wants you to go.
And I just go back to when he took over, they said normalcy's back. The adults are in the room. The world is on fire. Our country's on fire. Europe is on fire. The Middle East is on fire. China's on the march, even with their struggling economy, as they spread over to Antigua, I read today.
Right.
There, of course, they got bases in Cuba. But I want to talk about this column. I find it intriguing. The Trump trial, Columbia anarchy, and hope for New York. We're on WABC right now. Give New York some hope.
Well, I just make the point that, you know, rather jokingly make the point New Yorkers always historically think that they're the only place in the world that matters, the center of the universe. Wrongly, of course. But right, as you said at the beginning, at the top of this hour, Brian, New York is where it is happening right now. You've got these protests in Columbia University. You've got Trump on trial right downtown at the state courthouse down there. And of course, it's the left that dominates, right? You've got a left-wing Democratic
attorney general,
district attorney Alvin Bragg prosecuting Trump. You've had that with the state attorney general going after him on the civil cases. You've got these crazy left-wingers at Columbia University, faculty and students and everything else. And it's classic New York, right? New York's a deep blue state. You expect to see the far left. Trump, you know, I do worry whether Trump can possibly. You know, if you look at the makeup of that jury, we saw 13 of the 18 jurors and alternates get their news from the New York Times. Where do you think that probably leads them, Brian? What is that going to make them think in terms of the trial? So this is classic New York, far left in control, taking over, all political events. The point I'm making in my column is something behind the scenes underneath all this is shifting pretty dramatically, Brian. We saw, you know, Biden won New York, and that is that this New York is actually, I think, it's going to sound crazy, maybe, you know, I've been smoking something, but New York is becoming a purple state. Biden won New York in 2020 by 23 percentage points. According to the latest polls, he's up by about 10. This is, you know, this is the famous New York deep blue state.
As we know,
Lee Zeldin 2 years ago in the Democratic governor's race came with less than 7 points. He came within 7 points of defeating Kathy Hochul, the incumbent Democratic governor. I think things are changing. I think the Jewish vote, which is huge in New York, is turning dramatically against the Democrats as they see what's going on. And we're already seeing something that's happening across the country, which is Hispanics, who are obviously, again, a big, significant, big, important voting community in New York. They've had enough of the Democrats, too. So I think there's hope for New York. Yeah, I really do. Politically, I think things are changing.
Right. I mean, and you have a mayor who says a lot of good things. I mean, compared to de Blasio, he does a lot better. But his execution's off.
Terrible.
And he always goes halfway.
Terrible.
But he is on the outs with the president of the United States because he's been gifted 89,000 illegal immigrants and told to house them and feed them and don't get them jobs.
Yeah, and people are furious about it. Even look, long stand, again, this is New York City, one of the most democratic stronghold, 80% Democrat, and especially Manhattan, even more so. People are turning against him. And again, yeah, exactly as you say, Adams has been an absolute disaster. He's going to face a serious challenge in the election next year. Talk of, Cuomo running, possibly Andrew Cuomo running against him as on a sort of a more moderate ticket. But who knows? Maybe, we've had Republican mayors before in New York, Rudy Giuliani, most obviously. Maybe there's an opportunity there, too. Things are changing, Brian. People have just had enough of the misrule, the far left, the extremism, the radicalism of Democrats. And even in New York, the tide is turning.
I hear you. Gerard, final thought on Trump. If he is convicted in this, how much damage political? It's all projection and assumption. I got it. But what do you say?
I think, look, the polling always says when people are asked if Trump is convicted, would it change your view about voting for him? And there's always a small but significant number in a close election that says, yeah, I wouldn't vote for a convicted felon. I'm kind of skeptical about that. One, it's a hypothetical question, and people never really know quite how they're going to think once something has happened. Two, this is so obviously, look, you know me, Brian, and I've written this and we've had conversations before. I'm not Donald Trump's biggest fan. I think he's done a lot of things that he shouldn't have done. And I think there are some serious cases against him. This is not a serious case against him. This is, let's be really honest about it. This is a trumped up, forgive the pun, case brought by a Democratic prosecutor who campaigned, for the office of district attorney, promising to prosecute Trump in front, as I just said, of a jury of 13 members. Read the New York Times on a trial on a misdemeanor,
right.
What would normally be a misdemeanor, which he's somehow trying to escalate into a federal crime, into a state crime on the basis of federal law. We know this is bogus, and I suspect. Remember, thanks to the Supreme Court, I don't think we're going to be seeing any of the other cases coming up because of the Trump immunity stuff. This is the only case that's going to be tried. And I think if Trump is convicted, most decent, sensible, honest people are going to say this was lawfare. This was a political prosecution.
I hope so. Gerard Baker, editor at large of the Wall Street Journal, host of the Wall Street at Large podcast, Fridays at 7:30. And also the author of American Breakdown, Why We No Longer Trust Our Leaders and Institutions and How We Can Rebuild Confidence. Always trying to end up on a positive note and pick up his column today, The Trump Trial, Columbia Anarchy, and the Hope for New York. Gerard, great to see you.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks.
You're way
me.
Too productive. Back in a moment with your calls.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, when you think about people having a dog put down, and now I've had the experience with the dog we had in our family once had to be put down. You go to the vet, and the vet does it with a shot, and the dog goes unconscious, doesn't feel anything. Not a lot of people I know of have gone out and executed their own dog, and I think a great many people in America look at that and think it's telling. I think it's damaging, Brett. I really do. Cruelty to animals or shooting your dog strikes people as not normal behavior by, they will probably imagine, a not normal person.
But the fact that she wanted to say that is also telling.
Peculiar. I mean, if I were a political advisor to her, and that's not my department, but had I been asked for an opinion about it, I'd have said, don't put that in your book, whatever you do.
But you didn't, and it's the excerpt they got out that people are making a big deal about. And Kristi Noem about to put out a biography, hoping to be the number two pick. Certainly a leader to be somewhere in the White House should Trump win. But now, does Kristi Noem even respond to this, Allison?
No, she did. She said first on Friday that we love animals, but tough decisions like this happen all the time on the farm. Sadly, we just had to put down three horses a few weeks ago. And then on Sunday, she continued even more that the fact is in South Dakota, the South Dakota law states that dogs who attack and kill livestock can be put down. Given that Cricket had shown aggressive behavior toward people by biting them, I decided what I did. So she goes on to say she never shied away from hard decisions, whether in politics or in, you know, her life on the farm.
Well, I admit it is a hard decision to kill a 14-month-old puppy.
It's a horrible decision.
Very horrible decision that I don't think will get any better with time.
I mean, it's going to be interesting. She comes out, I think, next week with her book. She plans.
She'll be here, right?
She's supposed to be here unless things get changed. But as of now, she's supposed to be here at some point next week or the following week. So we will be asking her about it.
Some have speculated, knowing that Donald Trump does not like dogs, that she wanted to get on Donald Trump's good side by leaving it in. But you just wonder, are there editors for these books? Yes.
But the editors are also wanting to sell books. So by putting something extreme in there, they're going to want to keep it in.
Mm.
The editor's not looking out for her.
See, I don't think the editor put that out. I think someone found out about that, leaked that out.
Galleys start to come out early, too.
Right. But that's... Oof.
It's brutal.
It's brutal. Back in a moment.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We have the strongest economy in the world. That's a fact. 15 million new jobs created in 3.5 years. Unemployment hasn't been this low for this long for 50 years. Wages are rising. Instead of importing foreign products, we're exporting them and exporting American jobs. We're exporting American products and creating American jobs. Here in America, where they belong.
That is Joe Biden touting his economy. The problem is he is losing to Trump by about 20 points in every poll when it comes to whose economy was better. And he might trumpet those numbers, but the numbers aren't resonating. I mean, I actually saw protesters against Bidenomics last week, and that should have been the indication. You spent $40 million trying to sell Bidenomics. It failed last summer, so it seems like you're doubling down on it. Scott Bessent is here, CEO and Chief Investment Officer, founder of for Key Square Group LP, former adjunct professor, professor of economic history at Yale University, where you were a student too, right?
That's right, Brian.
Right, Scott. Great to see you again. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
So you've heard that speech before from President Biden. What is he missing? And why isn't it resonating?
Well, I think he's more confused than usual on the economy, and that they're publishing aggregate numbers. And what's really happening is the way the economic numbers are formulated is the higher income groups generate more GDP. So the economy is bifurcated, and the Biden economy is for the very rich. Like us, the top 20%, we're doing great. We've never done better. If you own assets, your house price is up, stock market's up, interest rates are high. The bottom 50% of wage earners are getting clobbered. So in America today, in the Biden economy, you either have debt and you're in the bottom 50%, you don't own a home, you have no assets, or you know it's party time because assets are up and you know, big companies are doing well. Small business confidence is at a 2-year low.
So you know that in 2025, the Trump tax cuts evaporate. They expire. What kind of impact have they made? And feel free to, you know, I know you can bury us with numbers, but from when you studied it, and you know President Trump pretty well, when you studied it, what impact has it made?
Look, it broadened the base. Is from 2017 when they went in, the 2018 or end of 17, 18, 19, the economy did well, but more importantly, the bottom 50% of wage earners did well. But this, it encouraged capital formation. And what we had was the Trump tax cuts created a demand shock, and the Trump deregulation created a downside, the supply shock, or an upside supply shock. So when you deregulated, you create more supply in the economy. That's why, you know, the real proof of the pudding for the Trump tax cuts is inflation never went above 2.2% when you had this great economy.
Right.
So the Biden economy, they're doing a demand shock, and it's not through private industry. It's through a 7% budget deficit. 7%. We've never had that. When it wasn't a brutal recession or a war, we've never had it during peacetime and prosperity. And with their overregulation.
Could you define that for me? What do you mean by 7%?
7% budget deficit. 7% of GDP is being borrowed every year. We are overspending by 7%.
Wow, there you go.
Right? We've never had that. Never had it. Except World War II, great financial crisis in 08. And look, that's when you're supposed to do it. And this makes me think the economy is running on fumes. Whoever comes in next year is going to have a mess. But one of the reasons we have this persistent inflation is they are stimulating the economy with the government spending. And the government spending's going mainly to the upper income people and to big companies. And then with the regulatory state, they are constraining labor. They're constraining the supply side. The only place that they are not constraining labor is with this chaotic and unlimited immigration, which is further pressuring wages of the bottom 20% of wage earners. And could you imagine if we had not had whatever the number is, 10, 12, 18 million new arrivals, illegal crossings, what the bottom 25% wages would be like? These people would be doing fantastic, and they deserve to do fantastic.
Right. I mean, everybody wants immigration just done the right way. Breaking our system has never been beneficial.
Look, we have a policy, 1.1, 1.3 million legal immigrants every year, and that this cohort who's coming in now, these are all taking blue-collar, low-income jobs. So like the Biden Fed and the Powell Fed are squeezing the bottom with interest rates, and then they're squeezing their wages with immigration.
So, by the way, so Scott, did you have a chance to look at the impact of the cuts? So some would say on the outside, and go, look, it's because of those tax cuts, we don't have enough revenue. That's why the deficit's growing. Do you feel differently?
Look, that's just, that's a canard. Is that it's spending. The revenue actually went up after the Trump tax cuts. Is we just have a case. It is a the Biden economy is a cynical economy of spend, and then Lael Brainard, President's chief economic advisor in the White House, gave a speech last summer, and she said, we're going to keep spending. We're just going to raise taxes in 2025. We're going to let the Trump tax cuts expire. And it will not be good for the economy. And by the way, there is no way that they are not – that they're going to be able to pay for all this spending without across-the-board tax cuts, not just on the rich.
So interesting. I hear this phrase, and it must drive you crazy as an economist who actually taught this at Yale. When the president says, we build from the bottom up and the middle out, is that even possible?
Look, I don't even know
what that means.
I don't think he knows what it means. He certainly doesn't know what it means. But, what's driving me crazy is, what I see in the press is clearly there is a group of journalists / economists / DNC operatives who've gotten the talking points from Delaware, and they're calling it a vibe session. Oh, Americans don't understand how good they have it. Basically, the beatings will continue until morale improves. And it is a bunch of linear thinking,
right,
sophistry from people like Paul Krugman, Alan Blinder. Now we're even seeing a little bit of it from people like Greg Ip at the Wall Street Journal. And it's just not true. Is the top 20% is doing great, and the bottom 50% is getting killed. And, I would refer you to last week, the Philadelphia Fed came out and said that credit card delinquencies are the highest they've been since they started measuring them. They're 3.5%. And I promise you, it's not the upper end that's going delinquent.
And when those interest rates go up, they affect the cards.
Yeah. So by pushing up asset prices, Powell, Yellen have made it necessary to keep rates higher for longer. Wow. So, you know, our stock portfolios go up. Everybody else has to pay higher rates on their credit cards for longer.
When you huddle with Donald Trump and you don't have to give up private conversations, but what's his focus when he talks about the economy? And because he got the tax cuts done, I know he was wanted to do trade deals. I don't know if China is off the docket, but what does he focus on?
Yeah. So, Brian, first of all, I want to emphasize I do not speak for the campaign. Only Donald Trump and Susie Wiles and her team speak for the campaign. But in terms of, you know, what's on his mind, it's what he's saying out of the campaign trail is he wants to extend the Trump tax cuts, maybe make them permanent. He understands that we are in a geopolitical conflict for the ages with China. And he is what goes underreported, which I will tell you from our conversations, mm-hmm. is he is laser focused on the threat of this debt and deficits.
Good.
And he, you know, is looking for answers on how to land the plane, how to get the debt and deficits down without crashing the economy. And it's going to be tough.
We only have 45 seconds left, but just your thoughts on what's going on at Yale?
Look, it's going on at every college campus, and Yale had done a good job of amping it down, and now it seems to have erupted everywhere. I think what's happening is unacceptable. I don't understand how the most privileged people in the world, these Ivy League students, are somehow trying to remake themselves into victims and searching for a cause that I don't think they understand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have told all my Jewish friends, like, I want to apologize for anything you and your family are feeling, and, you know, this too will pass.
It will, and we'll fix it because this can't happen in America. Scott Bessent, thanks so much, CEO and Chief Investment Officer and founder of Key Square Group, a former professor at Yale. Thank you.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Stuart Varney's going to have me on in a matter of moments on FBN, but what he always does is leave me a few minutes on the back end, and I'll be able to squeeze in some of your calls. We are following a couple of these stories. It looks like these Columbia students are still in possession of this Hamilton building. Named after Alexander Hamilton, where it's actually been the subject of a lot of takeovers. But this happened instead of them evacuating the campus and picking up the tents. They decided to take a building. So let's listen to Stuart.
On the side of your screen, that there, right there, is Brian Kilmeade. All right, Brian, thanks for joining us this morning. I want to get straight to these anti-Israel protesters at Columbia. They've occupied this building. What do you think the authorities should do?
Well, put it this way. How much longer can they hold out? First off, I'd cut the electricity there right away. I'd stop the bathroom, stop the water immediately. Number two is I think you got to tell the NYPD, be prepared to move in. You can't smash windows, take over a building, hold back 2 to 4 janitors against their will until they force their way out. And that's your answer to a 2 p.m. deadline yesterday to pick up your tents and go home and clear the square? I mean, at some point, this faculty has to step up. Here's the leverage. Here's what changed even to get that 2 p.m. deadline. 23 congressional Democrats told the administration of Columbia, get your act together, get those tents up. This is anti-Semitic behavior. Jewish kids can't even get to campus. You're embarrassing us. Sadly, I look for these other campuses who are following Columbia's lead, like NYU, to do the same exact thing. After all, what price do they pay, Stuart? They're still in there. Some idiots think they're heroes. They renamed the place after some child who allegedly died in Gaza. They have no idea about the true issue, but they're vehemently, as much as I believe they're anti-Israeli, I believe they're fundamentally anti-American.
Is that too? Now, why didn't the authorities see this coming at Columbia? That tent encampment's been up for, I don't know how many days. It might even go to over a week. Why didn't they see this coming?
Here's how naive I am. I thought they were going to put somebody right in the middle of that encampment just to be eyes and ears. You know, NYPD's got special forces who used to travel around the world looking at terror attacks to see if it would happen here. Those were the Ray Kelly days. But instead, they're caught totally by surprise. You know where the NYPD is? On the outside. And you know what everyone says? The biggest mistake the president of Colombia made was bringing them in. That's the mindset of the administration and these professors. Don't bring in the cops. You made it worse. What planet are they on? Their bubble's about to burst. They're being introduced, the professors too, to the real world, I hope, shortly.
The Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, suing the administration, the Biden administration, over the changes to Title IX, which are meant to protect transgender students. Several other states are also suing. Brian, what do you make of these new Title IX rules?
Well, they're terrible. I mean, to make it very simple, can this administration do anything that shows any courage? I don't care. I'm sorry this happened with this big push, this gender confusion that you're going through, but it can't affect women's and boys and girls sports. So you're going to have to compete with the gender you're born with, regardless of what you choose to do with yourself. Instead, it opens up to everybody. And therefore, your center midfielder, your young lady center midfielder, might be going against some gender-confused male who will literally take your leg off or break your head open. We watched in lacrosse these shots from the men who decide to be women that go cracking right into the heads or chest of these women, and they have to struggle sometimes for their lives. This is insanity.
Yes, it is. I'm with you on this one, Brian. Thanks so much for joining us.
You
see you again real soon. Thanks
all right.
A lot.
Go get him, Stuart. Thanks so much. Let's go out to Gary in Daytona. Hey, Gary.
Hey, thank you, Brian. No, on the issues of the protesters, it drives me crazy the last 4 or 5 days to hear when on Fox, especially, they'll have some roundtables, and there's always one person that will say, this is a glimpse or a snapshot of the university. And we should, if we pulled back and looked at the universities, we'd see that this is minuscule, this is minor. And I think that people can't let them get away with that statement.
You mean a statement? You mean do something about it, in other words?
Yeah. When someone says that this doesn't represent much of the student body, it drives you crazy.
I want you to hear Bruce Robbins, Columbia professor, on Sunday. He says the problem is us. And here's an example. Cut 20.
Genocidal speech should not be acceptable. It might be acceptable in the United States constitutionally. I don't think there's any place for it. On a university campus. I also think there hasn't been any on the Columbia campus. And the things that are brought forward as evidence for genocidal speech, like from the river to the sea or intifada, they are not genocidal.
Right. Causing for an uprising in our country. And also river to sea means wiping out everything in between. He is telling his students it's not genocidal. This is a 73-year-old Jewish white man.
Insane.
Right. Nuts. Thanks so much for the call, Gary. I'll add to that. Here's more from Bruce Robbins. He says the biggest problem is not law enforcement. It's law enforcement. Cut 18.
Most of the faculty and I think the student body think that what's gone wrong is calling in the police. That the protest was calm, well organized, not violent. There was little, if any, intimidation of anyone. And there are people who don't agree with the protesters who absolutely don't agree with bringing in the police. I think that's the single biggest thing.
So the police, they restored some type of sanity to the campus, allowed the tents to go back. He said, we all agree that the president shouldn't allow the police on, which makes you wonder if they agree that the police should not come on, what's going to get those students out of that building? They say not until they change policy. Really? They're going to stop investing in Israel because of some knuckleheads majoring in gender studies decides they want to put on a Yasser Arafat outfit and take over a building? Are you insane? I just cannot wait till all these kids or the young men and women are tossed right out of the school and have wasted their $72,000 a year. That's, I hope, all of them, that the police have to go arrest. Get that on their record permanently. Good luck getting a job. Unless these radicals ever get a job and want to hire you, but they usually don't work. Brian Kilmeade Show. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out when I'm going to be on stage next. Indianapolis and East Stroudsburg.
From high
atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
They always say New York is the center of things. And, you know, you'd say that and some people go, well, that's because you were born there. Well, it is the center of things more today than ever. You have these campus riots and chaos taking place at Columbia. Uptown, we wake up to the fact that they lost one building to these students who decided not only they're not going to leave campus at Columbia, they're going to take over Hamilton Hall. Then we have downtown NYU is starting to foment some unrest, FIT too. And, of course, we have Donald Trump trials, Donald Trump versus New York. And that's continuing. They took a brief recess. They're back in action. If you don't know, Donald Trump was fined $9,000 for violating the gag order. And they say next time we could put you in jail. We'll see if that what happens there. There's not much been happening at that trial, but so far there's been a standoff on campus. Very fortuitous time to have my New York Times bestsellers here in studio. Emmanuel Ochoa is here and Noah Tishby. They are authors of Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew. Emmanuel is a former NFL linebacker, current Fox Sports guy, Emmy Award-winning host, producer of the show Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. And Noah is a television producer in Israel's former special envoy for combating anti-Semitism and delegitimization. Wow, what timing, unfortunately, for your book, no, for you personally. What has it been like seeing this this raging anti-Semitism in this country right now?
Well, it's been, number one, it's been heartbreaking, but sadly it has not been surprising at
really?
All. Not at all. Not at all. We've been warning about this for a very long time. My first book, Israel, A Simple Guide to the Most Misunderstood Country on Earth, talked about campus anti-Semitism, talked about anti-Zionism as the new manifestation of anti-Semitism, talks about there's literally a subchapter called This New Hip Social Justice Cause that talks about anti-Zionism as this hit, like, cool thing that kids are taking on. And we knew this is brewing underneath the surface for a very long time. So it's heartbreaking, but it's not surprising. And I think this is a fortuitous time, as you said, for our book, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew, to come out, because it's probably the most uncomfortable time to be a Jew in recent modern history.
Emmanuel, it's like when you sometimes take a history class and then history comes to life and you're, wait a second, we're talking about the news because it has everything to do with the history class you're in. What's it been like for you to go to school on the history of the religion and the people and then this book comes out?
It's been incredibly educational. And the thing for me is, if you want to seek empathy in society, you can't seek empathy without education, Brian. And that's what I've realized is so often people are well-intended but poorly executed. I want to help. I want to help. I want to help. But you have no idea how to help. The first way you can help is to help yourself. Sit down, educate yourself, which is why we wrote the book. Educate yourself. Learn what the heck is going on, not just in the world, but in your world. So often we think that the issues are so far away from us that it'll never impact me. It'll never impact society. But on my plane flight over here, I was reading about how USC has canceled its main campus graduation, how UCLA has tension where a student can't go to class. My alma mater, the University of Texas, there were state troopers on campus and students were being arrested and all these different types of things I was seeing, all because of the tension not just going on in the world, but the tension going on in our own world.
So let me bring you to UCLA, and you posted this, but I want people to hear it at home. This is Cut 10. This is a student, freshman, and he's just trying to get on campus. It's obvious he's Jewish. I think he's wearing a Star of David. His name is Eli Sivs, and he was actually on with us on Fox and Friends this morning. He posted on Instagram, Cut 10.
Why can't I go? Will you let me go in? This can be over in a second. Just let me and my friends go in to class.
We're not engaging with that.
Then you can move. Will you move?
We're not engaging with that.
Okay, we're going. We're going. I'm going in. I have my hands up. I'm not hurting them. I'm not hurting them. That's what they do. That's what they do, everybody. You guys are promoting aggression.
So, Noah, people didn't see it at home. He's just trying to walk through the middle these women. He could have easily overpowered them. That's not his point.
No, it's not the point. Listen, this is... Germany, 1932. It's unbelievable that we're actually living through this again. And I think to the point of anti-Zionism being the new form of anti-Semitism, I think it's pretty clear right now that these things are intertwined. And what he said at the end of that clip was, oh, you're a Jew? No, that's fine. Are you a Zionist, though? And what people need to understand is that Zionism was taken away, was hijacked to mean something that it isn't.
What do you to say it means?
Zionism means it's a movement for Jewish liberation. So it's technically only the existence of the state of Israel. So if you believe that Israel has the right to exist, if you believe that the Jewish people deserve a state, mm-hmm. you're a Zionist. That's all it is. And it was taken to mean something completely different. So Zionism was taken to mean that it's a movement that necessitates the genocide of Palestinians. And that is what people actually think and is not true. And the fact of the matter is that 95% of Jews are Zionists. So if you say no Zionists allowed, what you actually mean is no Jews allowed.
Emmanuel, your thoughts about taking on this project, seeing what's happening now, and now knowing what you know about to be Jewish in this world and in America.
Well, I not only took on the project, I had to take on the pain for a moment. True story, I was at dinner in West Hollywood. Brian, and I was walking out of this restaurant, and I hear a murmur to my left. Again, for those listening, a true story. And I look to my left, assuming it will be a pleasantry exchange by maybe somebody who is familiar with my work. But as I look left, they simply say to me, "I hope they paid you well." I say, "Excuse me?" They say, "I hope they paid you well." Brian, I look them in their eyes and I say, "Who is they?" And the individual looked me dead in my eyes and responded, "Zionists." And so I said, "Look, my objective is to pursue love, pursue peace, pursue unity." Diffusing the situation, I asked, "Hey, what's your name?" The woman responded, "You don't deserve my name."
Wow.
I said, "God bless," and I walked out. It's not just a matter of taking on this project. It's also a matter of taking on the pain, because in that moment, for the first time, I felt scared driving home, because I said, if this woman is willing to address me in this manner in a restaurant on Saturday night in Hollywood, what might she or her peers be willing to do? Now, I am so frustrated and heartbroken by where we are in society, because there's so much pain, there's so much hurting, and it's not just in the Jewish community. Obviously, it's in the Palestinian community as well. And my heart's just really broken by all of the pain that's currently existing.
So I've been to Israel, but I feel like I do know it as well as somebody could know it, living in here and doing this on a daily basis for the last 25 years. By the way, I'm with Emmanuel Ocho and Noah Tishby. They have a brand new book. They're both best-selling authors. Together, they wrote "Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew." So, when you hear that, this has become an educational thing for you to educate other people, and now all of a sudden it becomes front and center. And let me ask this as sensitive as possible: if right now I went to Columbia and they were keeping black students off the campus, I think the president of the United States would have had a speech by 8 a.m. And you would say, this has got to stop. We're a racist country. This is more of a chance. For some reason, on some level, and you may not agree, Emmanuel, it's okay. It's relatively okay for to do it to the Jews. But if you do Hispanics, if you do it to blacks, it's outrageous. Of course, it's outrageous, period.
Yeah, I think Noah says something very eloquent at the end of the book, Brian. She says, I said, "Hey, can we ever stop anti-Semitism?" And she said, "Emmanuel, I don't know if we can stop it, but we can make it go out of style." After the murder,
I thought it was out of style.
Yeah, well, it was, and it's coming. It just came back.
You know, after the murder of George Floyd, at least in my experience, the racism that was extremely pervasive, we were trying to make it go out of style. You know, we were trying to make it go out of style. Clearly, there was still racism, there was still prejudice, there was still marginalization, there was still systemic oppression. But at least collectively as a society, for those next several months, we were trying to make it go out of style. Since then, things have kind of backtracked. But I do believe that, like, anti-Semitism, it's in style. It's almost not cool, but it's accepted to some degree now.
Yeah, 100%. It is accepted, and it feels like when the Jewish community is under attack, it's fine because you're using code words that are not Jew. I'm not saying this about the Jews. I'm saying this about the IDF. But what you have to understand is that anti-Semitism is not a simple racism. It's a shape-shifting conspiracy theory, and every few generations it changes. One time, it started out with, and we wrote about this in the book. So it started out before the days of Christ. There was a peoplehood. There's like the first account of anti-Semitism 200 years before the birth of Christ. And people are talking about these weird people. So it was peoplehood. Then after the birth of Christ, it became a religious-based anti-Semitism because of the whole the Jews killed Jesus. Then later on, it became, but you can convert out of it. So if you converted out of Christianity to Christianity, you were fine. You were saved. Then it shifted again to political and racial. So it was a racial-based anti-Semitism, and you can't convert out of that. And it was used for political usage. And later on, it shifted to anti-Zionism. The new form of anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism. It became this thing that is completely acceptable. And I think you're right. This would have been appalled. Everybody would have been appalled if it would have been any other marginalized community. But somehow when it's about the Jews, then it's totally okay.
Right. And also we could use this moment since everything's out and about and everyone dropped the gloves and dropped their mask except for those students. Maybe we could address it its core. Sure. I want to talk more about it, but I want to take a break so we don't destroy the next segment. Because it's not a podcast where I can just go for 3 hours, although we do make this a podcast. Help pick up the book, Uncomfortable Conversations with the Jew. We'll talk more in just a moment. Don't move.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Genocidal speech should not be acceptable. It might be acceptable in the United States constitutionally. I don't think there's any place for it on a university campus. I also think there hasn't been any on the Columbia campus. And the things that are brought forward as evidence for genocidal speech, like from the river to the sea or intifada, they are not genocidal.
Some river to the sea is not genocidal. I want you that is Professor Bruce Bobbins, who's been teaching at Columbia for 27 years. And he believes that. He sits there with the students every single day in their little pup tents. Emmanuel Ocho is here, and Noah Tishby is here. The name of the book is Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew. Noah, I wanted you to take that on. Well, what does the river to the sea mean?
The river to the sea means ethnically cleansing the Jews from their ancestral land. So the river is the Jordan River. The sea is the Mediterranean Sea. And when you talk about from the river to the sea, that's what you're actually saying. But here's the thing. These are not even half of what these kids are saying. When you chant, we are all Hamas, when you point out a Jewish student and you say those are Azzedine Al-Qassam's next targets, that's incitement for violence 101. So it's very clear to anybody that's watching that these demonstrations are not peaceful. There's nothing peaceful about them. They're violent. They're aggressive. And if you are actually going to a demonstration and you look like a Hamas fighter, a Hamas terrorist, or you look like you're being supported by the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, you might want to take a look at your cause there.
I think, Emmanuel, I heard in the 60s, we were even both too young for that, that when there was civil rights marches, that 60%+ of the white people marching with blacks for freedom and the end of segregation and everything were Jewish. What happened to that relationship?
That's a phenomenal question. James Baldwin wrote a great, great piece. It was for the New York Times, I believe it was in 1968, and I'll quote it. The title was, Negroes are anti-Semitic because they're anti-white. And I think the dilemma, I would say, is that we've gotten to such a vitriolic point in society now where we've deduced Jewish people to being white. And if we see Jewish people as white, and the tension between black people and white people in this country is at an all-time high, at least as it pertains to being recorded and publicized based upon social media, then you just have to group Jewish people into the bucket of oppressor, into the bucket of enemy, into the bucket of anti. And I think that is a part of the rub of what's going on in society is we have now collectively grouped Jewish people, which are all, it's an ethno-religion, but we've just grouped them into the white bucket. And so if you have animosity towards white people, then you will now have animosity towards Jewish people because you've put them in the white bucket.
Interesting. Do you agree with that?
Definitely. Right. I agree with that. And I also think that in terms of our cultural moment right now, it changed from judging, quote unquote, people based on their class, maybe money, maybe the content of your character, to oppressor and oppressed and melanin in the skin. And once you put these two buckets in and you look at the world through this prism, the Jewish community does not fit into that. And to look at the Jewish community, first of all, the Jews, some Jews are white passing, right? So a lot of the Jews in America are white passing. But that's not what the Jewish community internationally looks like in the diaspora, and definitely certainly not in Israel, right? And also the Jewish community was never afforded the same privileges that whites have been, the white Christians have been in in America and in the West. So our history, our culture, our background, and our collective trauma does not fall into the way we judge these things today.
How did you two find each other? You're both best-selling authors. So how did you find each other?
Great question. Well, 2 years ago, I reached out to Noah because I noticed some of the anti-Semitism that was in society. I saw the comments from Kanye West that, you know, Hitler had some good ideas. I saw the comments from Kyrie Irving, obviously NBA superstar.
He got suspended because of that.
Right? He did. He absolutely did. I saw so many of the comments and I said, you know what? There's a lot of ignorance going around in society. And I think ignorance itself, Brian, it's unfortunate, but staying ignorant, that's morally irresponsible. And so I said, you know what? I'm ignorant to some degree. Let me reach out to somebody who's incredibly intelligent, and not only incredibly intelligent, but has committed their life to this matter.
What did you think, Noah?
Oh, I cried. So, Emmanuel,
did you know about Emmanuel before?
I did know about Emmanuel before. I actually did, because he was speaking up against anti-Semitism as a non-member of the Jewish community, which was such a unique thing. So at the time, so this rise in anti-Semitism, the Jewish community has been feeling this. We know this was coming, right? So everybody knew that it's brewing underneath the surface. It became this pop culture thing of like, oh, don't worry about it. It's just Kanye. It's just Dave. It's just Louis Farrakhan. Don't worry about it. But we knew this was coming and brewing. And Emmanuel reached out to me at a time when a lot of people in the Jewish community did not know about this. And he literally said, I want your community to know that relief is on the way. And I remember I was standing in my bedroom and I just went.
And then October 7th happened.
And then October 7th.
What happened to the project after on October 7th and after?
After October 7th, the project fell apart. The book, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew, we talk about it. Chapter 16 is titled How This Book Almost Didn't Happen. Chapter 1 is titled How the Book Did Happen. Noah and I just had a sharp disagreement. We vehemently disagreed on a few subject matters. But what I love, Brian, is that that is the beauty of society. You can disagree. Like, you don't have to agree on everything. The book, we do not agree on a lot of things. It's me challenging. It's Noah educating. It's me pushing back. Hey, why the Jews kill Jesus is a chapter title. Are Jewish people white? Let's talk about the privilege that Jewish people have had. Let's talk about Zionism, anti-Zionism. So the book fell apart. But then when we came back together, we said, you know what? If we can get through this, we can get through anything. We can get through everything. And I hope that everyone listening realizes, I don't have to agree with somebody all the time, but where respect exists, where love exists, then disagreement can't prevail.
Real quick, where do you disagree?
We disagreed. The issue that happened was right after October 7th, and I don't want to give it out too much. It's in the book. It's called How This Book Almost Didn't Happen, and people are telling us that that particular moment is where everything becomes very intense and very real, and we even were asked, how are we still friends after it, which I loved, because of course we are, because the only way out is through. After October 7th, Emmanuel reached out to me and was very supportive. And then he asked me to do his show, Uncomfortable Conversations with Emmanuel Acho. And I did it, and I didn't realize that he was going to have somebody else on the show, which is not the fact that she's Palestinian is great. That's not the issue. The issue is that she's very extreme. And it was one of these moments of I obviously believe in freedom of speech to the utmost extent until it calls for my obliteration, until it calls for me to. I'm not for jihadism. I'm very clearly not for that.
I don't think anyone should.
And yeah, that's where we had a strong disagreement. And after the book fell apart, we decided to put it in the book. And we're very happy we did that.
Emmanuel Acho, Noah Tishby, thanks so much. Go up, pick up their book. They're both best-selling authors. This is going to be a huge hit. Uncomfortable Conversations with a Jew. It was great talking to you. I just need 4 more hours. Right? I'll talk to you again, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back in a moment.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
There seem to be 4 justices who are really taking Donald Trump's claim of criminal immunity seriously. And we are, I mean, I know it sounds like hyperbole, but I think your opening is so correct that we are essentially, as Neil put it, one vote away from sort of the end of democracy as we know it, with checks and balances. And to say it's an imperial presidency that would be created is frankly saying it would be a king. He would be criminally immune. And that is what is so shocking, is how close we are. And we are really on the razor's edge of that kind of result, but for the Chief Justice.
Right. That's Andrew Weissman, Jonathan Turley. So besides that, he's not hyperbolic at all. And I don't think he's really overstating how bad things are going to be with that king, Donald Trump.
You know, it really is just breathtaking. I mean, you have people saying that, I think it was Whoopi Goldberg that said that he's going to make gays and journalists disappear. And, you know, at some point, the ratcheting up of rhetoric gets so out of hand that everyone just tunes you out. But, you know, this is the guy.
But they are tuning him out. He wouldn't be even close in the polls if they believed this. That must be so maddening. If they believe this, he wouldn't be winning.
Well, that was a hilarious thing at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, because you had the host saying, I can't believe this election is tied, to this huge audience of journalists. And I wanted to stand up and say, it's because no one's listening to you.
To you, yes.
I mean, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but when you've spent years with this framing of news and this open bias, you're basically talking to the same 30% of every poll.
So Andy McCarthy wrote this column today in the National Review, and he says how Alvin Bragg's prosecution of Trump violates New York State's Constitution. I'm not sure I know it violated the Constitution, but he lives this. I mean, he was the one trying the blind shake.
Yeah, no, he has a wonderful perspective. And I think that the judge has already committed very likely reversible error. Now, he can try to correct that with instructions, but the instructions would make no sense, because he's not only gagged this the leading presidential candidate during the final months of the election,
right?
But he's also told the jury, or allowed the prosecutors to tell the jury, that there were campaign violations here. So those members of the jury actually believe that the payments made to Stormy Daniels were a federal violation. They were not. And I think that alone could well be reversible error.
So I pointed you to something this morning because the Cubs are playing the Mets, not because Jonathan wanted to see me in person. Jonathan in town to watch, see if they could make it two in a row over the Mets at Citi Field. They won in extra innings. So I asked you, I told you in the morning, did you see that Michael Cohen is on TikTok? And he's raising money for revenue, asking people's questions. And your answer was,
this guy is totally insatiable. And it's almost mesmerizing to watch him, because he has these series of redemptive moments where he says, I was a sinner and now I'm free. And just recently he said, I will comment no further on the trial. Then he went on to TikTok and trolled for money. But for those of us who have criticized him from even when he was representing Trump.
You've always thought he was
a thug. I mean, he's a legal thug. I mean, he threatened students, threatened journalists. He had really these profane messages he would leave for people. And what's interesting is, even though they're setting up this entire trial for Michael Cohen, which is just a thought that most lawyers would loathe, but they are setting the table for his arrival. But what did Pecker say? Pecker said, well, he sort of exaggerates and he yells a lot. And then another witness said, yeah, everything is urgent to him and in a crisis. I don't know how they're setting this table, but it's not very appetizing for the jury. But now you've got this guy. It's not just that he lied when he said that he wouldn't talk anymore, but he's going on TikTok to do what he always does, and that is to troll for money and troll for opportunities. He has this weird skill set, you know, that he's willing to go with powerful interests, and he has such great moral flexibility that it's a market advantage.
So this guy, Vic Baja, do you know him?
No.
He's on fire. He was on Fox News at night, a criminal defense attorney. He says Michael Cohen is still making money off Trump. Cut 50.
From everything we've seen, Trace, it didn't sound like Michael Cohen was the litigator of our generation. It looked like he was a fixer who was really willing to fly close to the sun.
Yeah.
The question here is, how much of Cohen's actions did President Trump know about? It would not be rare for a president or anyone to say, hey, you know what? I'd like to win this election. I'd like to save my marriage.
Yeah.
So why don't you do what you need to do to put this potentially false story to bed? And the question of raising an LLC and then having the money go through that is something that is typical. An LLC is a holding company, and there's nothing untoward here. The issue is Michael Cohen has been declared by both judges and by his own convictions to be a liar.
Right.
If you're a liar once, the jury in any case is entitled and sometimes directed to discount the testimony from that witness.
You challenge that at all?
No. I think the funny thing about this trial is that they're proving uncontested points and making it sound like they are, you know, establishing critical crimes. It's like saying that he created an LLC is like saying, you know, he sent an email, ladies and gentlemen, an email.
Right.
You know, okay. I mean, LLC is something you can legally do. You can have NDAs or non-disclosure agreements. All of these are largely uncontested, and they're not criminal. That's part of the problem with the system that we have is that you have to go through a whole trial for other judges to look at some of these issues. And in the meantime, a presidential election is going forward. Many of us do not believe there's a crime here. Many of us believe that the judge has already committed reversible errors. And yet we all have to go through this trial.
So what they're going to try to establish is that if you're the defense, you say, I don't know what he was doing. Told him to fix the problem. So he's promising things, opening up accounts. And they'll turn around and go, he knew exactly what we were doing. Why would he reimburse me for the exact amount that I put in that LLC? What's your answer?
First of all, we're going to have this extraordinary moment where you not only have a person's former lawyer testifying against him on the stand, but basically telling the jury, I think you should send my former client to jail for following my legal advice. I mean, all these witnesses are saying, yeah, Michael Cohen set this up. Michael Cohen said this. So obviously he went to Trump and said, I've got this tied off. It's all done correctly. And yet he's the one who's testifying and Trump's the one who's charged. That's just – I think many people look at that and just see that as rather bizarre.
After he's already done prison time and now is under house arrest, right?
That's right.
Or tax evasion. It's tax issues, correct?
Yeah, and he dodged a perjury charge because, you know, he later said that he did not speak truthfully when he took the earlier plea. Well, that was under oath. And he did that on the stand. And many of us saying, okay – he just admitted to another act of perjury, and the Department of Justice just pretended it never happened. All of us were standing there like, whoa, how many times do you see a witness actually say on the stand that he lied?
How different is that from Alan Weisenberg, who is now back at Rikers Island at 74 right. years old for a second time because they say he perjured himself in the civil trial?
Yeah, I that's the problem that we're having is there it is hard, in my view, to deny that there is not two systems of justice here. And, you know, you have all of these individuals that were nailed for anything they could find short of ripping a label off a mattress. And then you've got people like Michael Cohen, who seems at times to be a perpetual motion machine of perjury, and yet he just seems to always be able to avoid it. Even when he went to jail, you know, he's able to get out sooner. And even during that period, he was accused of lying. He was accused of lying about not being able to appear.
So having said all that, people always point out Sammy the Bull. Sammy the Bull's murdered dozens of people, but yet he was a credible witness against John Gotti. Correct?
Right.
Does that apply here without the death and the blood and the mobster? Can you just say, yeah, I made some huge mistakes. I was lying a lot, but this guy is the one I lied for, and here he is.
No, look, there are plenty of witnesses who are tainted, but you sometimes in a criminal conspiracy, those are going to be your witnesses. And in the case of the Bull, you know, he was a hitman who was saying, I got these orders. There's a bit of a difference when you're dealing with someone's lawyer who said that they had appropriately tied off some scandal with a legal device and is now saying, I think you should send my client to jail for that. I mean, the problem with Cohen is that the thing that he has most been criticized for is lying. You know, it's not like I'm saying that the Bull was a better guy. He wasn't.
He wasn't.
But you have someone who just recently – a judge said is a serial perjurer and is still gaming the system. That wasn't 10 years ago, 5 years ago, last year. That was like weeks ago. And they're going to put that guy back on the stand.
Todd Blanche is the attorney that the president liked most. and he left a lucrative law firm, I think he has a partner, to defend the president. Evidently, in today's story, Trump is venting about his lawyer and the criminal in this criminal trial. He wants a more aggressive Todd Blanche. Your thoughts about that? We're not in the courtroom, right, but we read accounts and we have great reporters who have given us information. Your thoughts?
It's hard to judge. You know, from what I've seen, it seems to me like his team is doing a good job. I mean, they're scoring the points that they need to score. I would not have been aggressive towards someone like Pecker. Why? He was giving you stuff that was actually quite valuable. I mean, their lead witness said that he did this for other celebrities. He said that he had done similar things for Trump going 20 years back. Since he was doing this for Arnold Schwarzenegger, was he trying to get Schwarzenegger elected president or Rahm Emanuel? He was doing this because it was a celebrity tabloid, and this is how they would deal with celebrities.
Buy the story, kill the story.
That's right. And he also said, look, I don't think my viewers would have liked a negative Trump story because they liked Trump. Now, does that mean this is all great and copacetic? No, it doesn't. There's lots not to like about this. But none of that is criminal. And the problem I have with this trial is I cannot imagine how those jurors could get to this point in the trial and not believe that there was an original crime here committed by Trump in terms of federal election law. And that's simply not true.
But if you're a good defense, can't you do that? I mean, you're anticipating this. That's in our heads. We're wondering, isn't that what you do as a defense attorney?
Yeah.
You go, guys, you don't like it. It's totally legal. Question. No, totally legal. Such and such. Totally legal. This is not it. You know, did we violate federal election law? The answer is no. But is he being charged with that?
Yeah, and the thing is, they did try to bring down the opening statements. The general rule, I was always told, you never interrupt your opponent in opening or closing. Something, by the way, the government violated in this case. They did interrupt. I have to tell you, I would have broken that rule when that prosecutor stood up and kept on referring to election campaign violations as a fact. But clearly, the judge is letting them do that. And at the end, I'm going to be intrigued by the instruction here. It's his job to instruct the jury on the law. Most judges I've been in front of, the most of judges I've watched, would never have allowed a lawyer to say that to a jury. Would probably have just said, look, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to instruct you on the law. He's going to instruct you on the facts in his argument. But at the end of the day, he has to lay this out for the jury in that instruction. What is he going to say? Is he actually going to say that this was a campaign finance violation when the Department of Justice turned it down? They didn't even impose a civil fine against Trump.
But I thought if you charge someone as a felony, if they do it, oftentimes it's a fine first, and then you see there's someone or something else there?
Well, it depends on what it is. But the thing is, they looked at this. They had – obviously, they had Cohen in the bag in terms of testimony.
Right.
And the Department of Justice – it's not like the Department of Justice was reluctant to indict Donald Trump. They seemed to be on a hair trigger, and they did not indict him. But many experts say, no, this isn't. This is the John Edwards case. It collapsed, and that's the reason they didn't do it.
Friendlier jurisdiction, I imagine.
Yeah, I expect
right?
so, yeah.
Well, does defense speak last?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, after the government finishes its case, you're allowed to put on your case in chief. Usually what the defense will do is they'll stand up and they'll ask the judge to dismiss the case. 99% of the time, the judge says denied, and they'll say denied here. Then the defense has a choice at that point whether to put on evidence or not. And this becomes a very dodgy question for defense. If they feel that the government has made its case, sometimes they will rest immediately. Because they just feel like they've at this point they could win with the hand they have. So I don't know what they're going to do. What I have to tell you is that I would think it would be a colossal mistake for Donald Trump to go on the stand. I mean,
there's no way.
Oh, my God. I mean, why would you? I mean, with the order the judge gave, the order said you could ask all of these things that seemed completely irrelevant, but he's going to allow him to be cross-examined on it.
Jonathan Turley in person. How are you getting to the game?
Well, Subway? I don't know if I'll make the game tonight, but I've been watching on TV. But I loved I loved the ninth inning last night, I got to tell you.
Because you're not a Met fan.
But I'm here for you.
That's
support.
That's twice, man. Yeah. That's three times. Thank you so much. Jonathan Turley, he's the best. Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. It's just great to have Jonathan Turley in studio. There's so much going on. We're also following things at Columbia where things are heating up on the outside. Also, the fact that it's a beautiful day, people go, yeah, I might as well go protest or go watch the protests. As far as we know, Hamilton Building is still being occupied. We know the White House came out with a stronger verbiage against that. We also know that Donald Trump's on trial downtown. As I just spoke with Jonathan Turley, we have a banker on now to talk about how Michael Cohen opened up an account, an LLC, in order to, they assume, and they're going to testify, be able to put it into an account and be able to put the money in there, get it to the person they want without people knowing it, and then kill the story. The question is, how is that election interference, and how is that just not electioneering? You want to pick up your positives, get rid of your negatives, reduce them anyway. That's why, for example, if you didn't get great grades like Al Gore, he would not release his transcripts from college. Why? That is election interference. Why can't I know everything? Well, you can't. I'm not getting them. Donald Trump, I'm not releasing my taxes. Oh, yeah, you got it. No, I don't. I'm not going to release my taxes. Oh, is that election interference? I need to know everything. No, you need to know with the best part that you're a candidate. You need to do the best thing possible to push your case forward. But the bigger story, I think, and we don't have enough time, I'm going to get to some of it tomorrow. Some audio is now out of a podcast with Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Joe Biden. It is fascinating. Also have Nancy Pelosi going off. I think I want to see if I can squeeze that in. Do you think I have time? Probably not. Going off when questioned. When they were saying that Donald Trump has lost more jobs than anybody else in history, MSNBC host Katie Turr came out and said, well, he's in the middle of a pandemic. And she went off. If you factor that with James Carville cursing his way through a podcast because young people aren't voting for him, and you see this anger and bitterness, hey, you got 6 months. What are you seeing internally that makes you wonder why Donald Trump is winning and guys a legitimate shot of winning? You know what it also shows? No one's listening to you guys.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.